This is Mark Steiner. Welcome back, everybody. We're about to have a conversation with Rebecca Walker. It's been a while. She's written a novel, her first novel, called Ade, a love story. She's named by Time magazine as one of the 50 most influential American leaders under 40. And I just found out she received the award of who could be president from the League of Women Voters. Find out what that means. And she's author of books like To Be Real, Telling the Truth and Changing the Face of Feminism, Black, White, and Jewish, Autobiography of a Shifting Self, Baby Love, Choosing Motherhood After a Lifetime of Ambivalence. And, of course, as I said, the book we're about to talk about, Ade, a Love Story. And, Rebecca, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Oh, such a pleasure to be here, Mark. I always love being on your show.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've been looking for this as soon as I saw on your Facebook page that this book was coming out. It was like, oh, okay, here we go. So this is a great love story, I'll let our listeners know, between an American woman and a Kenyan man that takes place and we're going to talk about. So the first question is always a typical question, but so this sojourn that your character made, who doesn't have a name in here except for Farida,
mm-hmm.
right? Which we'll talk
yeah.
about, the name that she was given by the man she fell in love with.
Mm-hmm.
Did you make, not necessarily falling in love, but did you make this similar journey? Did you spend time in on the coast of Kenya? Is this part of...
Yes, it's a very autobiographical book, but I did, but it is fiction. I mean, yes, it's autobiographical, but it's also fiction.
It's
autobiographical fiction. Which I think we're seeing a lot more of these days. I mean, you know, sort of explicitly autobiographical fiction. It's almost a new genre. I think memoir has, I love memoir. It's definitely my form. But in the last, I think, 5 or 6 years, certainly since the James Fry incident, there's been a kind of breach of trust between the reader and the writer in memoir. So I wanted to create another world that people could enter with abandon, you know, without having to wonder if it's true, if it's not true,
uh-huh.
but could just, you know, take a journey to a magical place and a magical romance.
And the place sounds magical, and I think you also kind of open a culture to the world. You made me start listening to all this Lingala music. When you refer to it in the book, in this Dodu, is that what it's called?
In Lamu, you mean
yeah.
the island?
Yeah, Dodou.
Lamu, yes.
Yeah. And so the Lingala music, I should say, and so it's it really kind of grabbed me. It's this kind of this mix of cultures in this world you were in.
Yes.
And
well, the music is definitely the music of the independence movements that were sweeping Africa in the 60s. And, you know, Cuba was a part of that.
Right.
And many different instrumentations from different sort of folk communities all over the continent. And they blended together to create this music that was, you know, when I heard it there in Lamu on this gorgeous island, I was mesmerized, and also I felt liberated by the sound itself. It was so bright. You know, it's like it's a high life. It's connected to high life music. So it's got this very optimistic but very strong rhythmic tonality. It's a beautiful music, and I hope that my readers go and find it because it's really amazing.
No, it is. I was discovering as I was reading the book, and one of the things I think that's interesting about this is your exploration also kind of getting deep into the culture of the people of that region and the multiracial ethnicity of the people of that region and what Swahili is. Because, you know, Swahili for a long time, at least in America, especially in revolutionary radical circles, was the language of Africa for many people in the 60s and early 70s. The reality is, as you take this journey, Swahili is this amalgam of everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's very complicated, actually. So Swahili, the people where I was in Lamu, the entire culture there on this island is the people identify as Swahili people. So the language Swahili comes from their point of view out of Tanzania and Kenya, and especially that coastal region, including Mombasa and Malindi and the Zanzibar, all of that. So, yes, that was a part of the revolutionary language. And I think that was partly because of the connection to Nkrumah and his sort of independence movement there in Tanzania. So then the Afrocentric movement started to use Swahili words like Umoja and all of the different days of Kwanzaa that all came out of Swahili culture. But then, well, those words did, but not necessarily the ideas. But then Swahili began to become identified as actually a colonizer's language because it was and is an amalgam of, from some linguistic point of view, an amalgam of Arabic, Portuguese, and indigenous African language. So it is embedded with the oppressor's dynamic. So there's this weird sort of push-pull with Swahili, both the culture and the language. But I fell in love, and my character fell in love, with a man who identified as Swahili and spoke Swahili. And both Farida and I came to speak a lot of Swahili and came to be a part of a very vibrant, embracing Swahili community.
One of the things that I thought about very quickly was that the whole Swahili culture made me think of, in some ways, of Western African diasporic culture as well, because the amalgam, you know, you know, that both were kind of born out of slavery and slave trade between these two
and
worlds.
And that was very true, yes. That was very, very true in Lama, where, you know, my first impression when I approached the island was instantly I thought of slavery because of the architecture. There was so much sort of Arab Portuguese aesthetic there. And obviously there was quite a bit of slave trading that happened from that region around through the Indian Ocean route and around to the other side. So as opposed from going West Africa across over to the Western world, quote unquote, these slaves were brought from that eastern coast around through India and back around. So it was a completely different trajectory, but definitely very, 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 very prominent there. And when I talk to lots of people, they actually remember their very close ancestors being slaves, not just taken away, but actually on the island. Mm. So it's very it's a very powerful place with both horror and joy, you know, co-emergent, as we often find. And I felt very at home there, actually. I mean, I think that's one of the things. I felt very at home. Farida feels even more at home because everyone is this mix, and the people really look like her. You know, they're Arab, Portuguese, and African, and she's this mixed race person from America, where people don't look like her at that time. And so she goes and she feels very much for the first time like she's in the majority, that people appreciate her aesthetic and her beauty. And that is part of why she falls in love with this person and why he falls in love with her, because he recognizes her in a different way than people in America are able to.
It was a falling in love that is part of a lot of people's own kind of myth-making and dreaming. By that I mean a woman coming from a biracial woman coming to the east coast of Africa, but coming from a very upper middle class creative family, Yale graduate, coming to a place that is Islamic, and this is a woman of no faith, coming to an Islamic world which is not as oppressive as many Westerners think an Islamic world would be. But it's an entirely different world of, it's not even working class. It's a world of people who make their living with their hands and on the water and a very different place than we are in. So these are the kind of love attractions that happen instantaneously, but they're fraught with all kinds of contradictions because these are different cultures that are just miles apart.
Yes. And you know, one of the challenges, I think, for me writing the book was not wanting to fall into the kind of trope of, you know, the noble savage,
right,
or the sort of overly romanticized African, return home to this idealized African culture, or a kind of, in Buddhism you call it spiritual materialism. I guess in, you know, we would call it sort of, what do we call that now? there's a term for this, for like tourism that's sort of appropriative and exploitive. Like, it's not sex tourism, but it's like, there is a, the two of us were... We said this. Anyway, I was concerned that there would be that kind of fetishizing of the other, fetishizing of the African male body. And so I think Farida really tries to take some responsibility for her own romanticizing of this place and this person ultimately at the end. And she has accused her white friend of being the one who does that constantly, but then at the end she has to take some responsibility for also projecting some idealized notion onto the entire relationship, the idea that all boundaries could be transgressed, that there was this sort of perfect other. And so that was something that I gave a lot of thought to. And you know, readers will tell me if I'm successful or not, but I didn't want to replicate that old trope. And yet I did want to be very honest. So it was a tricky rope to walk. But I think that both of these characters fall in love with their idea of the other world. So Ade is also transfixed in some ways by the idea of America and the kind of woman that America produces, as he sees in Farida. So there's this kind of mutual admiration / projection going on in their relationship. And yet at the same time, it's a very pure elemental connection. And so, you know, how to honor both of those was really my task as a writer, how to allow for the complexity there, not just sort of deconstruct it and boil it down to nothing. You know,
yeah,
to just a kind of, you know, reductive political reality, but to give space and agency for true love between two people, no matter what the overlay of politics.
I mean, there was an overlay of politics, and especially when you run the passport issue and trying to get his passport and the whole dictatorship of Daniel Moy and. At that point in Kenya and the repression in Kenya that took place and your confrontation, your character's confrontation, I should say, with the police on the bus and all that that took place, which was very real and very vivid because it is how it was and how it is in many places still. But this in some ways was also, I mean, this is different. I mean, your other books really were like these kind of vivid social and political portraits of different aspects of our existence seen through your existence.
Yeah, this is very different,
right?
In a way, right? I mean, I, in some ways, I feel like as an artist, it's a real departure for me. I felt much more free. For the first time, I didn't feel like I needed to have the book. It's not an activist book per se. I think with all of my other work, I've been very focused on wanting to really shed light on different ways of being that are outside of the sort of hetero, you know, nuclear, white, heteronormative, all of that. I wanted to deconstruct that by showing the complexity both of my life and the lives of the people around me. And so all of them, whether it's they're about feminism or new family configurations or new forms of masculinity or multiracial culture or having a baby within feminist ideology, they were all very focused on asserting a point of view that was outside of what I've considered the mainstream view. This book, you know, is very free. I didn't feel the need to make a huge statement. Like I'm not trying to do any of that in a way. I'm just trying to create a beautiful place and a beautiful space for people to dwell for just a little bit, you know, for just a short period of time, to remember the love they had in their life, to feel again. It's a very emotional book, I think. It's more like reading poetry than reading prose, you know. I mean, that's my perspective.
It's more like writing poetry.
Yeah.
It's like an epic poem as a novel.
Yeah, well, that's nice, but it's still prose.
Is it? No, but it's prose. No, absolutely prose. Yeah. But it seems to me, if I'm prying into me, shut up, Mark, and I'm not going to talk about it. It's fine. But it seems to me that in some ways you can write fiction Mm-hmm. Make things up in your head. We all, people who write all do this. And most, some of it is based on some reality you've experienced, it's seen, and all that's true as well. But there's something very real about this. There's something about this that is almost like part of a love story that you have lived through that you're telling in a different way. Probably one of the reasons she doesn't have a name until a third way through the book.
Yeah. Well, she doesn't have a name because in some ways he gives her an identity that she had been longing for. So he gives her a name, gives her a place, he gives her a home that she did not have. But it's true that part of that has to do with the connection between the character and myself and trying to leave that space open in a way, you know, to allow for me to be there and not be there at the same time. I don't know if that makes sense, but as in my creative process, I needed to do that.
It felt like you had to experience love this. You had to experience a love like this before really writing it, because it was so real in terms of what happens in terms of this attraction that is explosive that you didn't expect.
I mean, definitely. I mean, there is deep love. There was deep love, and yet I think it's a love story that hopefully many people have either, you know, I want people to remember their own love stories that were as powerful and to honor them. I really wanted to honor the love that I felt in that period with that person. Mm-hmm. I wanted to sort of write him an ode in a way, you know, to thank him for all that he gave me. I think that my dream is that all people who read it can either remember a great love or now sort of be open to a different kind of great love that they didn't anticipate. That they celebrate love in a different way.
Right.
And also that they realize, you know, that there are challenges to love, and even if it doesn't work out in the way that you think it will, the love is still enduring. You know, that love can't conquer all, but love also can't be defeated. You know, that it remains. So it really is. I mean, it's an ode to love.
It is, and it's a beautiful love story. And one of the things, it really is, it really grabbed me because you could feel it in it from both of you, from both characters in the book. And Ade, one of the things I loved about Ade's character was that because of the way the West looks at people in what we call the developing world, we'll look at a man who is a fisherman and a Muslim on his dhow, going out to get his fished and bring it back, and the family life he lived, how he physically looked, how he treated this American woman with such deep love and respect and awe, and as this gentleman character, this strong, powerful man, gentle character, and this American woman. That to me, that was important. For me, that was important for a part of the book because you don't always see men like him portrayed with such deep humanity as, you know, because that's how we see that.
And that was important to me, too, that if there is an activist element, I mean, there is this, you know, the portrayal of the Muslim world is so different than the Muslim world that I experienced. And the idea of the Islamic man and family sort of subordinating the feminine was just not part of my experience. What happened instead was I met, I think, one of the most inspiring human beings I have ever met. And he was much more loving and appreciative and respectful toward me, certainly at that point in my life, than any other man had ever been. And it wasn't just me. It was the way he treated his mother and his sister and his aunt and all of the women in his life. And that was, when I talked to him about that, that wasn't because, well, it was because of who he is, but it was also because that is what he was taught from the Quran and from his teachers at the madrasa. I mean, he was taught that women should be respected and women mm-hmm. should be cherished, and he took that very seriously.
mm-hmm.
And so while I arrived and thought it the opposite, he showed me very patiently his interpretation of Islam, and it was so moving, and I was my view of the world changed forever. And I wanted to give that character, I wanted to show that character, because I have not seen that character coming out of American culture at any point that I can remember. And yet that person exists. And he should be recognized, you know? And I think that would go a long way in helping us to stay away from demonizing and polarizing and stereotyping and coming to these assumptions about huge groups of people where there's great diversity. I'm glad that you felt that way.
No, I really did.
He was a wonderful person. Yeah.
And it's also this kind of the awe that both characters felt of the other and the other culture.
Yeah.
The opening for both.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. So he was a lot, in real life, he was a lot less, he was less enamored with the West, so he was excited by it, than he was with her, you know, and... There was just something very special about the connection that did have the element of transcending the cultural divide. I don't know. Mark, it's so interesting. This is the first book that usually with my books, I have such a clear sort of agenda. Like, I know exactly how I want it to sit within the culture. I know exactly sort of the language and what discourse it should fit into. But this is, it's so different for me. It's almost like a degradation sometimes to think about it or even to talk about it in that way. You know, I feel like it is what it is, and I don't want it to be taken apart or
yeah.
I don't know. I just feel very. I feel a different way about it than I felt about any of my other work. I'm not quite sure what it is, but.
And I think anybody who read this book, who even saw themselves in this book, would love the book.
Yeah. Good.
It is a wonderful love story. I mean, And as I said to you, I think before we started this conversation on the air, and it reads very quickly and easily, and you just roll right through it. It's just digestible. You can feel it. And I think that, you know, you feel the love of this culture in East Africa. You feel the love between these two people. You feel the complexities of relationships between all kinds of people in this book. And it has just enough of that kind of, to me, this kind of literary nuances thrown in all over the place. Names of books and writers and singers.
I tried to refer to books that there are a couple books in there that she's reading, you know, like Pablo Neruda's The Captain's Verses, this is one of my favorite collections of love poems. Isn't this a wonderful book? Marguerite Duras, The Lover, obviously is connected. Ayikwe Arma, The Beautiful Ones Are Not Yet Born, which is such an important book by such an amazing Ghanaian writer who shaped my writing, certainly, in a lot of ways. And so I tried to kind of point to other books that I think this book owes a great deal of depth to, and also to encourage the reader to explore those other titles, you know, that those other worlds. I tried. I did my best.
You did a good job. You did a really great job.
I showed up. I love the book. I don't always, as a writer, you're never totally satisfied, I think. You hope that you're able to achieve what you set out to do. But then at the end, there are always things that you want to be better. I think all writers feel that way. I do. But with this book, I'm kind of letting go of that. I think that it's going to have its own life. And, you know, I just got a note from someone yesterday who said that it's like she was engaged to Ade, almost as if Ade was a soundtrack to her life. She, she was driving with her boyfriend, and she wanted to stop at the ocean and take a photograph of the book held up against the ocean. And he said, "Are you crazy?" And then they stopped, and she took the picture, and he turned around and proposed to her. And so, the idea of it being this love story and being a part of other people's love stories is very exciting to me. And if that and only that happens, I will be a very happy writer.
Well, you should be a happy writer on this one because you've done it. And I think this is just a lovely little book. And I really encourage our folks to read it. I think that it's just something to take with you. It's not beach time unless you're going to Hawaii or something, California, Florida, otherwise. But it's sit or curl up around your living room, put on the fireplace times, and grab the book.
Good. Good. I really appreciate that. And I appreciate, this is part of such a large body of work. This is my seventh book. And it's the first one that isn't in this sort of more activist vein. And so I really appreciate the support of my readers and people like you as I make transitions as an artist. It's not easy to do and bring everyone with you. And so I appreciate that,
Folks, I can only say
appreciate you.
Thank you very much, Rebecca. That made means a lot. Folks, read Ade, A Love Story. And Rebecca Walker, thank you so much for bringing us this wonderful tale.
Thank you. You're welcome. It's been my pleasure.
Mine too. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go